accession number 11939, reel 11.
Mr. J.L. Williams, Reel 11. When did you move to Devon, Mr. Williams?
Well, I couldn't be precise, but it must have been late September, beginning October, I suspect, when we left Bridport and Lyme Regis area and moved into Tiverton. And I can only assume that the coastal function, the pressure had gone off the coastal business there. And they were just taking us back further in to do a little bit more training in different territory.
Where were you billeted in Tiverton?
Now, if I remember rightly, we were billeted in some sort of schoolroom place, you know, some sort of schoolroom. Or village hall, I'm not quite sure, but it was that capacity, you know. And we just moved in by 3-ton truck as usual. We were still presumably on a sort of mobile status, but we certainly went in for a lot more intensive training. We were really training as soldiers when we got back
from
the coast.
What form did that take?
Long marches, fatiguing marches. We had Colonel Percy, Joss Percy as we called him, or as he was known rather reverently by us, the Black Prince. He had a very heavy black moustache, and on occasions when he was annoyed with us, it almost used to stand out from his face like a straight edge, you know. And he used to really push us around. I mean, for example, we would do a full pack, just over 20-mile march, and then 1 mile out of town in Tiverton, there would be the band waiting with Joss in charge. And we went in, finished our thing back with a mile at regimental marching pace. No, just to make sure we're right. For a long time, it was like walking on ball bearings. We were walking on blisters so much. But after a while, we began to take a little bit of perverse pride in being able to do these sort of things, you know.
You say marching with full pack. What exactly did that mean? What were you
Well, that was full water bottle and small pack at the side and the big pack on the back, complete with blanket and greatcoat and that sort of thing, you know, and gas cape. I often think when I look back on those days, we used our gas cape, although it was intended originally to be protection against gas. It was used as a waterproof, a windbreak. It was very close-knit stuff, and if you put the hood over your head, your ears were kept warm. And if you were in the middle of the night on a manoeuvre or something, you wrapped yourself up in it. It was very effective. As a matter of fact, then and in Africa and Italy, we did a lot of our sleeping with a blanket wrapped around our waist. We stood up and put a blanket around our waist. Then we put gas cape over our head and lay down, slept the sleep of the just. And that was the way we went on. And there was one thing which I found of interest. It was, I think, on some manoeuvre we had there. You know, there was an arsenical gas, which I'd experienced when I was on the gas course. It used to give you a sore throat, that was the arsenic, presumably poisoning, and it reduced your morale. I believe I mentioned when I was on the course, they closed the beer bars. The remedy was a quick drink of whiskey or something, just to sort of stimulate. They closed all the bars and let us suffer so we know what it was like. And on one occasion when we were in Devon and so on, they filled one of a little coombe the road went through. They filled it with this arsenical gas. We marched through it. Thing is, you didn't know you'd had it, and perhaps I was one of the first to recognise what it was when my throat started paining. So, and that was one of the things, you know, teaching us to experience these sort of things. I also believe it was on Dartmoor or Exmoor, where we did some moving up closely under an artillery barrage. the live 25 pounders, getting as close as possible, as we would presume to have to advance when we were fighting the Boche, you know. And it was much more realistic training, and we were probably a lot fitter.
You were training with other arms of the service?
Yes, well, we were a brigade, you know, 6th, 8th, 9th, roundabout. And we had artillery supporting us, when we live artillery. And we had engineers. We were working as a sort of military unit in the foreign field.
Did you train with tanks?
I don't recall that we did very much training with tanks at that point. Although I remember on one occasion when they had some of these infantry tanks out. But the thing that struck me about it was we were over on the moor somewhere, and they seemed to break down. We knew they were there. I can still see their sort of rectangular bulk, but they seemed to break down. We moved off, you know. So that our training with tanks was a little bit, what shall I say? We didn't train an awful lot. We knew they were there. On one occasion, we were following up, you know. But it was, looking back from later on in the war, I realised it was just to let us see a few tracked vehicles, really, because it wasn't very effective training, you know.
Did you link up with aircraft, you see, anyway, the RAF?
No, the only thing we ever had in aircraft were Lysanders. I remember on one occasion we really thought we were sort of getting a little bit technical because we strung the notice upon a wire and the Lysander picked it off, trailing wire, picked the message off, and we really thought we were getting into high technology, you know. But that was the main, Lysander spotting planes and that sort of thing, you know.
Was your role any different? Were you still a platoon sergeant?
I was a platoon sergeant. Oh, yeah, yes, I was a platoon sergeant. But also, Colonel Percy, he once, I always remember, this was a slap-happy sort of thing. I was giving one of our platoons a talk on gas, based on my... And Colonel Percy slid in at the back without my knowing it. And when I'd finished, poor old, what's his name? Later Colonel Wood, you know, George Leslie, got it wrong. This sergeant is trained and a skilled instructor in use of gas. Why hasn't it been used before? Get some of these people. And before that, I was giving gas lectures and talks to all the battalion. I've been having a happy life. and just suddenly discovered I had a Q1, which was, I suppose was as high as you could get. But this, I got it in September before, you know. A year before, actually, you know. And
was the morale and the fitness of the battalion like at this time?
Very fit. The morale was very good because, you see, although we'd had our losses at Dunkirk and so on, we were still pretty well... Same thing, you know. There were lads missing, you know, but certainly hadn't been decimated by any degree by Dunkirk, you know. And we still had this tremendous local morale, you know. We could still talk about places like Chopwell and so on. Although, as I believe I said, we had quite a few Cockneys and so on with us then, and it was the usual sort of kidding going on between Southerners and Northerners and that sort of thing, you know. But it was very, very high morale, very good and closely knit. And, of course, being light infantry, we thought all other forms of infantry were sort of rather inferior sort of things, you know. And I think morale was quite good.
Had you received any new officers and NCOs who stand out in your memory?
No, I don't think... We'd had... there were one or two officers... If I remember rightly, there was one or two senior officers turned up, whose names I can't remember, obviously filling in gaps, making homes for some of the old regular officers and so on. But not many subalterns, you know, not many new subalterns, that sort of thing. We had three blokes who'd been in the light infantry, right, or had been in the infantry right at the beginning of the war, and they'd been commissioned... early on, and they came back into the battalion, been NCOs, I remember rightly. And they were Geordies to the extent that they spoke like Mike Neville speaks, you know, they spoke There were certainly Geordies, because they spoke with that sort of North Country accent, which you get on people like Mike Neville and so on, you know. And then we had one or two young blokes who come from Ochtill, who were obviously from, I remember one called Lieutenant Hartnell, and he was very definitely a South Country officer, you know, he came from London or somewhere like that. I think he'd been something in the city or somewhere, or training to be something in the city before he was called up. And it's a strange sort of thing. Our other officers still had pronunciations, the short pronunciation, North Country pronunciation, and his South Country accent, or Oxford accent more than South Country, stuck out like a bit of a sore thumb, you know. And there was, perhaps in those days, we were still a Geordie battalion, you know, and things like that were noticed. You know, if you do something, well, he's a southerner, you see, he wouldn't know any better. This was, you'd hear some of the chaps talking among themselves, you know. It was very, very strange.
The quality of the officers and NCOs, how would you describe that?
Well, the officers were good. I mean, they did everything we had to do. And it would have been God help them with Jos Percy if they had ever failed at all, you know, because he stopped a lot of pub crawling and that sort of thing with all the officers. And woe betide any officer who said to the sergeant, well, just carry on, I'll fall out. He would be up on the mat with that any doubt. NCOs, well, there were still such a lot of NCOs and warrant officers from the old battalion, you know. It's difficult to say. There were... I really couldn't criticise them because I was one of them myself, you know what I mean? Some we probably thought we were good, let's put it that way. It really should ask someone else. We were just, I suppose, still basically a territorial battalion, you know. I mean, when I think of it, we'd been called up I'd been called up in August 39. And effectively, except for one or two courses and so on, I'd been in the company of the battalion all the time, you know.
I think. How did the people in Tiverton and that area receive you?
They were very friendly. Very friendly. Although, strange enough, we've got one or two of our old soldiers who come to see us now and then at our DLI association. And some of them were married in places down in the Midlands, you know, Ships and on Stour and so on. There don't seem to have been many who got an association with... they didn't marry girls from Tiverton, or that sort of place, you know. And... But the people were very, very nice. Very nice indeed. Very friendly. When I look back, I don't know how the devil they were, because if I suddenly had some strange soldiery planted on us round here, I'd be very critical, I suspect. But I don't know, they were extremely nice, the people in Devon. Very nice.
Parades, discipline, had that increased in any way?
Well, discipline was very strong. There was no nonsense, and it was... Heaven help anybody who sort of got drunk or made a fool of themselves. It was really... I haven't got the slightest doubt that Colonel Percy was doing it on the old army style, you know. The old-fashioned army style. And it was quite good. I don't remember any sort of trouble at all. And... Again, we were still in the stage, and there was sufficient number of us of the old thing, so not to want to let the side down, because we were still territorials from Gateshead and so on. So perhaps it's a bit difficult to assess that. But I don't remember any unusual... There was the odd blokes who sort of... But I don't remember much absenteeism surrounding them. I'm sure I would have heard a lot about it if I'd been being a sergeant, you know, especially in our lot, you know.
Normal routine duties like parades and guards, were they going on?
Oh, yes, yes.
What kind of thing were you guarding? Kind of
well, the guard, there were mainly... In the thing, it would normally consist of the battalion headquarters, the company headquarters, and then roaming pickets. And, of course, there were always calls by pickets around places of amusement and drinking at the appropriate times, you know. Much more genteelly than we did when we were parading in places like Lille and so on, and emptying their estaminets, but still. And again, it was the old thing there, where if you'd been in a place like Aldershot or anything, if you found somebody sort of acting with her, you'd have had his, somebody would have held him while the other one looked at his paybook and so on. He said, hey, Joe, go on, get home, you know. We were still in the stage when there's that BF so-and-so. Get home, can't get that phone, or he'll get, make a muck. And so we sort of edged our people away off the street. And they went, of course, because they knew that we weren't playing. But the fact was that one was inclined to, if the law rule said you will arrest anybody found drunk on the street after so-and-so, we're more likely to say, go on, get yourself smart, get yourself off home, or you'll be in trouble. And they'd go off. So it was still a little bit sort of civilian type discipline.
Well, what form did the leisure activities take?
Well, we played football. We also had, strange enough, some running, some cross-country running of a sort. And it was mainly, I mean, being a Geordie, it was mainly football and platoon games and company games and that sort of thing. And that's as far as I remember, you know.
Did you meet civilian teams? Did you play amongst the civilians?
No, it was mostly playing companies, you know. A company would play B company and that sort of thing, you know. We went out in pubs and so on, and you saw people. And I remember there was some of our blokes. There was the daughter of our lady next door, who we sometimes used to go out and have a drink with her and her husband and her daughter, you know, a few of us together. Nothing romantic, just friendship, you know. I mean, I've no doubt there were romances going on, but people didn't shout about things like that, especially if they were married, you know. But I think when I look back, I wasn't a married man. I hadn't had a lot to do with young ladies because I'd been going to evening classes and I didn't know many of the local girls because I was going to on the bus to work every day and coming back at night and that sort of thing. So I must have been a rather innocent sort of specimen, really. And of course, once I was in the army, I was so interested in the army that I probably females came second choice. But there it is. I can't remember anything of startling nature in the. I can imagine what it would be like nowadays.
your living conditions, food and sleeping quarters, how good were they?
As far as we were concerned, good. We got plenty of grub. It wasn't bad. We had one of the... there was a fellow called Oliver. He was one of the muckiest-looking characters ever, but he was our company cook. And he seemed to turn a lot of food, but we used to eat it, and the food was very good, you know. We probably ate better than civilians did, you know. And sleeping... I don't know. I suppose... we had our normal issue of blankets and we got trained to it by then. Certainly we never had any complaints. No complaints at all.
The duties of the battalion, as you say, were basically a training situation.
Well, I should say it was a training situation. Getting us fit, you know. And I haven't got the slightest doubt, although we didn't know it, that the battalion was getting ready for overseas, you know.
And there was no indication of that at this time?
No indication of that at all. We had a pretty good idea that if we were, would go overseas, it would be somewhere out in the Middle East because we couldn't think of anywhere else where it would be. But there was certainly no indication of that. We were just ploughing away at all sorts of training. But there was a sort of feeling somewhere that as it moved us back from the coast and Dorset, and we're moving us into sort of lowlands and fells around about Devon and so on, that they were training us. And it probably didn't, they weren't training us to stay in England. And but that might have just been romanticising on our part. You know, we didn't, nobody told us. Everything was very tight, that sort of thing.
You went on a small arms course. How did that come about, Mr. Williams?
Well, I went on a small arms course in December 1940. At the Hythe Wing. I suppose I was reasonably efficient in small arms. But I think, it sounds awful to say this, but I think, you know, this sort of thing came up. Somebody was wanted for a course. And I've no doubt somebody somewhere among the junior officers said, well, that fellow, he got a jolly good mark when he went to the gas course because he got a Q1. He'll not let the side down. You know, I don't think it was because I was a brainy or anything, but simply because they wanted somebody who was average intelligence, who wouldn't produce anything bad sort of thing. Actually, what I produced was an A2. I got on the course, I passed out as an efficient instructor, A2 and B2, which meant that I was A2 was for instruction and B2 was for handling of weapons. So I must have been about second grade, with A for handling the weapons and B for...
Can you describe how the course was arranged and organised?
Well, it was, you know, the army, Hyde Wing of the army was a small arms school for the whole of the British Army, and was down at Hythe, down on the Kent coast. And this was the same course which had been moved up to Bisley, which was again a place well known, Bisley. And we did care of the rifle, handling the rifle, bayonet fighting. I often think ironic in these days of high quality weapons and so on. We did bayonet fighting when we had to thrust at sacks which were hung up and so on. And at first, the instructor used to have a stick for showing us how to land. And when we were attacking, we used to have to get up and charge his sacks in, out, withdrawn, and into the next one, that sort of thing. And then when the thing was finished, we had to stand down, and we had to move our rifle across from, to our left hand and hold up our right hand. So the instructor could look. If we'd been shoving hard, we should have cut the inside of our thumb and forefinger on the backside of the rifle. So he looked to see if we were bleeding there, and if we weren't bleeding there, we hadn't been doing the job properly. It was a rather strange way. And we then had to fire. We fired, of course, we fired the Bren gun, the rifle and the Bren gun, the anti-tank rifle, the boys, this horrid boy's anti-tank rifle, which frightens you to death. If you didn't, they used to sort of improve your morale by saying, if you don't hold it properly at the shoulder, you'll break your shoulder blade, you know.
Was it as bad as that?
I held it in tight, and I just got a jerk, but not see, if you hadn't, it would hit your back, but when you're holding it, you just move back. And we fired the 2-inch mortar, you know, that was a little one with a wheel on, which you actually fired the trigger, you see. And that was it.
Did you also learn to take the weapons to pieces and put them back together again?
Yes, well, not the rifle, of course, but the Bren gun and so on. Oh, we would do it with a blindfold on, you know, for assembly. I suppose that was just to do it in the dark and so on. But those of us, of course, I've fired a Bren gun before, but those of us who'd been territorials on the Lewis gun, we always used to say, well, of course, the Bren gun's too precise. It hits what you aim at, whereas the Lewis gun used to spray a little bit. So if you fire at one man, you'd kill a man on his left or right as well, you know, there's a fair chance you would. But otherwise, it was...
Did you have any preference for a particular weapon yourself?
Myself? No, I used to like the Bren gun, but hidden in my heart somewhere must have been some regard for the 3-inch mortar. Because subsequently, after I was commissioned, the first time I saw mortified, that's my weapon, you know, and was for the rest of my army career, you might say. But I don't think I was an artilleryman in the sense, you know. I mean, a mortar was a rough and ready sort of thing, you know, the drain pipe, you know. But I really liked it, and but I liked the Bren gun, and I liked the. Later on, the 3-inch mortar, which we didn't touch then, because the mortar was a specialist weapon, you know, it wasn't the ordinary infantry weapon. There was a mortar platoon in the battalion, but we ordinary rank and file infantry just had the Bren gun, anti-tank gun, anti-tank, boys anti-tank rifle, and a 2-inch mortar.
Firing these weapons, were they always in one position, say the prone position? Did you have to fire them in other positions?
No, we fired the rifle from a sort of kneeling and sort of one leg position, but we fired the Bren gun into the air from a tripod for anti-aircraft, you know. But that was about it. It was mostly prone position. But the other thing was making quite sure that your rifle was clean. I spent an awful lot of time cleaning a rifle. That was it.
Are there any secrets to keeping a rifle clean?
No, just it's your thing, just polish all the time, you know. There were one or two gentlemen who would give a surreptitious pull through with a little bit of metal polish, but they were detected and dealt with rather. No, just keeping things clean and so on. And handling the rifle, you know, carrying it to the point of balance and that sort of thing, you know.
Were you given a rifle when you went there, or did you take your own
rifle? We took our own rifle.
So that was your own personal rifle? That was
the rifle which we had, yes. If I hadn't been to France, it would have been a rifle I drew at the drill hall, no doubt. But there it is. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed there was a bit of competition, you know, and one had to run forward and fire and that sort of thing. And the instructors were first class. But you couldn't joke with them. If you start to try and get a little bit funny, you suddenly get some very intensive drill, at the end of which the instructor would say, "Now, I make the jokes around me, and you're the people who laugh. You don't make the jokes to try and make me laugh," you know, that sort of thing. We say, "Yes, staff," because they're all referred to as staff as instructors, you know.
Were they from a variety of regiments? Or?
Yes, they were obviously presumably the pick of the regular army, these people were, you know, because it was a regular army school originally, and a lot of these chaps would be picked as instructors because of their capabilities. And without a doubt, they were good trainers.
Was your target practice always on fixed targets, or did you have any firing with figures that were behind bushes or hills?
We had these business when we're looking in a certain direction and they put a target up and pull it down, that sort of thing, you know. But in the main, it was just accuracy and taking the collect pressure and that sort of thing, you know.
And at the end of it all, there was a test or examination?
Yes, you were tried out in various things. I don't remember a written test, but you had to sort of drill a squad and instruct a squad and so on. And there was drill, and you were examined while you were given the order to advance and get on and fire and that sort of thing. And I suppose the marks were on that.
How long did the course last?
It lasted from the 3rd of the 12th to the 23rd of the 12th, which was 3 weeks, the day and back.